Morning, Julian. Lovely to see you this morning. Thank you for meeting with me about this particular talk on bushfires, biodiversity and urban development. This started because of the massive bushfires that we had over the summer. And I started thinking urban professions, architects, planners, landscape architects, we all have a part in the interplay between nature and man-made. And I thought, surely we can do something about these bushfires. How are we part of the problem? How are we part of the solution?
There's, I guess, part answers to this at all, number of different scales. I definitely can't talk to the building scale and building regulations about building bushfire zones. I can probably only speak to it at a metropolitan or perhaps a district scale. If we look to the metropolitan scale, so Perth's in a biodiversity hotspot, one of only 35 on the planet, and they're regarded as the life support systems of the planet. And biodiversity hotspots are also characterised by not only having high degree of species which exist nowhere else in the world and can't be just offset, but also the fact they've been cleared substantially. So the Southwest Australia biodiversity hotspot has been 93% cleared. There's only 7% remaining, and Perth continues to sprawl into the hotspot, often in the form of bankshire woodlands. And the way we develop sprawl to pretty much obliterates those systems. There was a plan which the previous state government and consultants and government officers worked on for years called the Green Growth Plan or the Strategic Assessment, which was very much about trying to come to an agreed urban footprint for Perth, which could be developed to achieve optimal urban outcomes, but also with minimum destruction of biodiversity. Unfortunately, that's been on hold under the current government, and it looks like it's on ice permanently. So that's a great shame, because that had the potential to start to reconcile urban development and biodiversity hotspot at that metropolitan scale. So in lieu of not having that, I mean, Perth is a very has a very strong planning system, but it's been very difficult to control urban development on the fringe. To bring it back to bushfires, the problem is as we eat into the biodiversity hotspot, we create bushfire vulnerable areas because they're surrounded by bush in some cases. The way we've developed too also means there's incredible complexity to the linear edge between urban form and biodiversity hotspot or remnant vegetation, which makes it very difficult to police from a fire perspective because the perimeter of that edge is so enormous. And the way it kind of eats into the biodiversity hotspot is very much like termites eating into timber. Mm-hmm. It's not a kind of, it doesn't present a monolithic edge that can be easily defended. It's very complex.
Right.
So a huge linear length to be defended against fire. And now we know that Perth's rainfall is falling, and it's fallen since the 1970s. We're getting more extreme temperatures, we're going to get more extreme fires, and the way we have dealt with suburban expansion into biodiverse land, I think, is going to become increasingly an issue.
Yes.
On the fringe. And you know, we did get some premonition of that in the last few summers. So it's concerning. Look, I've talked about the problem, I'm going on a bit about it here, but I think the default response to this would be to say we need to do more on urban consolidation. Mm-hmm. And we need to try and lock down the edge of the city. We need a stronger urban growth boundary. We need to go like Portland did, which is draw the line and you don't cross it. You know?
Yeah, this is sort of the argument that has been around about densification of urban centres for the last 30 plus years. You know, way back, even in the early 90s, there was talk about this. Mm. So why has that not worked, or what have been the problems with doing development along that sort of densification area?
The problems have been numerous. There's a community sullenness around infill. Mm. Around Australia, it's particularly prevalent in Perth. The Grattan Institute say that 13% of people support infill development in their own neighbourhoods. I suspect in parts of Perth, it's probably much less than
13%. Yeah, that's right. I was thinking that's low, but I'm sure that's lower.
Yeah, and we don't live in an autocratic state. It is a democracy. And the problem for planners is they can enable this stuff. And planners, local government planners, can draw a line around an area and go, put density here.
Yes.
But if the community doesn't support it, it leads to development uncertainty. Developers hate uncertainty. Mm-hmm. And frankly, when you compare it to a greenfield development where they don't have to contend with these kind of uncertainties, it's no wonder they just go off to the fringe and do what they do, because that machine is well-oiled. Yes. Whereas the infill machine is kind of, it's vulnerable to so many more uncertainties. And there's a whole bunch of other things like our lot fragmentation. How do you kind of piece together enough bits of earth to be able to do something decent with it? It's not easy to do in the suburbs. often you have a situation where state government sets infill targets and then the local governments are just expected to somehow deliver it, even though...
they don't know how, there's no guidelines.
Yeah, we live in a kind of neoliberal society. They can't, the local governments can't deliver it. They're not staffed to deliver it.
Yeah.
They're not trained to deliver it and they're not funded to deliver it. So, they just kind of throw their hands in the air, and local government councillors are often elected to prosecute a backlash against infill. So there's a whole bunch of, in that system which would otherwise deliver coordinated medium density infill, such as the government, state government ones, there's all these kind of vicious feedback loops which make it really difficult. And also Perth has not had particularly high land values in the last few years either. Mm. So it's not like medium density outcomes are just being forced in the way they have been in Sydney.
So we're not politicians, so therefore we can't enact policy to, you know, draw the line, as you said, etc., on urban expansion. So what are some of the things that urban designers, planners, landscape architects can do? What's out there in terms of innovation for infill development?
Mm-hmm. Christina Ramalho, an urban ecologist, and I, both from UWA, we wrote a book recently called Green Space Orientated Development.
Mm-hmm.
And that book is really about going, given how deep the suburban dream runs in the collective psyche of Australians, and frankly most of the world.
Yes.
We should be trying to work with those forces and use it to deliver a kind of compact city model which actually reflects those prevailing desires.
Yes, and they continue, don't they? We keep seeing the same formula over and over again, but just squeezed into these tiny parcels of land.
So I think a lot of the appeal of suburbs is leafy greenness. It is about generating some perceived equilibrium between nature and culture in an urban setting. I know I derive tremendous benefit from having a backyard which is full of big trees, and I feel it in terms of mental health and physical health, and all the data supports that. So what we came up with is an idea of what we call GOD.
Mm-hmm.
So it's Green Space Orientated Development. It's
like
a take
that.
On TOD, which is Transit Orientated Development, which is what the state government's trying to do, which is just plonking density on train lines around transit hubs. So it's the idea that you can get to work easier because you live right next to a train station. But it hasn't resonated particularly well. Really, the policy's been in place for 20 years. It hasn't delivered much other
that
than
long.
Coburn Central. Mm. Our problem with it is that life is about a lot more than getting to work.
Yes, that's
and
right.
And I'm not really sure that that many people in Perth, particularly families, really aspire to truly urban living. Like, I think we don't mind coming into the city and experiencing it, but then you should get back in the car and go back to the suburbs
where
you belong.
To your backyard,
a
little bit of greenery.
Yeah, you don't need to live in this stuff. So the book is a critique of TOD, and it pushes the idea of green space orientated development, which is that we should upgrade these green deserts, the parks of our middle ring suburbs, which are just really about kicking balls, and turning them into wonderful communal backyards for people living at a higher density around them.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is the parks can then do more things for more people more of the time, where you can program in different functions, which can change over the years in relation to a changing demographic.
Mm-hmm.
But there could be things like artist studios, there could be community gardens, it could be wetlands, it could be areas to exercise dogs, there could be a skate park, there could be a BMX track, it could be a beach volleyball court, whatever you want.
And the occasional oval.
And yes, and you keep the ovals, well, you keep some of the ovals and you make them more multifunctional.
Yes,
and you
I
use
understand.
Them more times of the day, evening, night, and all that sort of. So it's not about active sports is important, and we have a childhood obesity epidemic, so you'd be an idiot to say we don't need active sports, but I think we've gone too far that end of the spectrum. We need to also look at more passive recreation and people's experience of nature. So these parks would be drastically revegetated.
Mm-hmm.
Not with necessarily bush native species, but they would become the complexity of a suburban back garden, sort of realised at the scale of a park.
Yeah.
So that's what we think is one answer. As for what urban designers and planners should do more generally, I think they should be proponents of God.
So do you think that urban designers, planners, architects are well-versed enough with the concepts that you and Christina talk about in your book to implement GOD, GOD, into urban spaces? Or do you believe that this particular idea is so far out of their everyday practice that they require a little bit of an extra course or something along those lines? Obviously, the way you and Christina have laid it out is a step-by-step guide on how to implement this. Is there a gap to be filled if you want to see architects, etc., implement GOD into the suburb?
Yeah, I think there is. And this book is a kind of manual as to how to do it, but it's a brief manual and it requires a lot of fleshing out. The ideal thing would be to get a case study up and running somewhere and ground test it and do a longitudinal research study around it. Unfortunately, because of the constraints under which we're now working, that hasn't found any expression on the ground yet. Well, I wouldn't really have expected it, that it would have been at this point, but there's a gap there, absolutely. It needs someone who can really push it.
Yeah.
And someone who can, bring local and state government and developers along on this. We have talked about trying to set up a process by which that would happen, but as to now, it's proven elusive just in terms of the resourcing of doing that.
I've just heard that government has discounted fees in urban design courses by 60%. That is a big announcement. What do you think government is seeking in urban design, landscape, architecture, professions by doing that? What are they wanting out of us?
I can't speak for them exactly, and I don't know quite. I mean, I'm glad they made the decision, but I'm not quite sure why they did. But Australia is one of the most urbanised countries in the world, people mm-hmm. living in the city. I think we'll make or break this nation on the basis of how well we plan our cities. And they, given the gathering storm of climate change, I think people like Brendan Gleeson talk about cities as being lifeboats for humanity to take enable us to weather this storm.
Yes.
So how we design the lifeboats is going to be critical to our survival. Is that what the federal government's thinking? God knows. But if I was them, that's what I'd be thinking.
I had similar thoughts as well, where I thought that government obviously sees us as the people, the professions in between the natural and the man-made, and we are nearly the steward professions of ecology, so that, yes, as you're saying, humans can continue to be viable on the planet rather than by our actions make the human race not viable on the planet. Therefore, I thought, it seems to me like all these urban professions are slowly developing into this mix of ecology and man-made. If you set up one of these enabled parks, then do you believe that the way to turn this hate of density around by having a park in this green site orientated development style?
Yeah.
And then people will see how lovely it feels and they'll go, oh, this, yes, in my backyard rather than not in my backyard, you see? And then there is scope to convince people to densify in terms of the built part.
Yeah, that's a good point.
How do we bring everyday mums and dads to realise that this is the future of humanity, that this is the future of cities, and how do we turn this, oh, density is awful, into them wanting a mix, a symbiotic relationship between the built environment and nature?
Well, firstly, we need to produce planning documents which are basically conceive human nature and conceive of it realistically. I think people are not that altruistic. Particularly when it comes to investments in housing, and particularly when it comes into their personal livability of their home environment. They may indeed not want the city to sprawl, and I think you could argue to most people why sprawl is not probably a good thing in this 21st century.
Sure.
And most people would agree with you. On a conceptual level, they'd be totally on board. However, if you then measure their resistance to sprawl against the enthusiasm to really perhaps negatively affect their personal living environment or their personal investment in real estate.
Yeah.
The personal dimension of it is much more pressing for people. Mm-hmm. So people are altruistic, but not to the degree they're going to go, well, I'm going to accept detrimental influence on my personal lived experience of my suburban house because I don't want sprawl. I don't think people think like that at all.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to be giving them a reason, selfish reason, why they should be supporting, which goes beyond altruism to your fellow human being.
Yes, that's a fair point.
So that's where God comes in, because you deliver an upgraded park from a park that was pretty much unusable for a lot of people.
Yeah.
So this flows from experiences of social bonus zoning in Vancouver, where basically the greater number of people accept urban consolidation policies, the more money is then dedicated towards streetscape upgrades, better daycare, parks, plazas, all of this gets upgraded. So you can see a demonstrable benefit for you supporting growth, not just tolerating growth, but supporting growth.
The upgrade is not just the park, it's also the entire community and various social aspects of that community.
Soft infrastructure as well. So I get annoyed with people who always cite Vancouver as the answer to everything, but it does seem like they're onto something there. There are sort of some local government policies which resonate a little bit with social bonus zoning, but not in a really comprehensive kind of way. If you live in somewhere like a middle-ring suburb like Belmont, you've had your urban canopy cover has been slashed now down to just about 5%. By way of contrast, Dalkeith, they've resisted infill, and their canopy cover is more like 30 or 40%.
Yes.
But you in Belmont, no, you swallowed the pill. You know, like you said, we'll do infill. You want infill, we'll do infill. But you hacked up every back garden in Belmont. You now have 5% canopy cover. So what have you got out of that? Well, personally, as an existing, what was an existing resident, what did you get out of it? Parking hassles? a hotter suburb, a suburb with less biodiversity, a suburb which is less able to deliver mental and physical health benefits from mature trees. Have you had the activation of urban space? Like, is there now a really key urban space which is really humming because of the extra people?
No. Yeah, no.
So it's the worst of all worlds. It's not a proper suburb, and it's not a proper urban area either.
Mm.
And the problem is now you've hacked up every back garden in Belmont.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot unpick it. And now you're stuck with this urban form, which is really not well adapted to the kind of challenges mm-hmm. we're experiencing.
Yeah.
You wonder why communities would be NIMBY. I'm
That's
surprised
right.
not more of them are.
Yeah. In that, I hear things like, you know, Greenleaf is just the rich. I find that that's social injustice.
It's true then. It's demonstrably true of Perth.
Absolutely. Yeah, I hear you. I hear ecological vulnerability and social vulnerability.
Mm.
So I think a scheme like you and Christina are proposing in your book starts to resolve this by providing first the park and enriching. That park is enriching that community. Then the park will convince people to live in that place, and then more people will want to come, and therefore the local government has the reasons to upgrade the density in those suburbs.
The problem with our solution, though, is you upgrade the park, and then because of hedonic uplift, the property values around it all go up.
Uh-huh.
So it could have a gentrifying effect where it drives out people who can't afford to live in that area because the uplift from the park, and it's deliberate, the idea of uplifting the property values around the park is that you then generate more council rates and taxes as it densifies as well. But we have a problem too. It's so hard.
It's
dynamics
tricky.
Are tricky to master.
Yeah, yeah. I feel we are sort of dealing with the dynamics of how nature works, and we're starting to only scratch the surface of that. That's what we're finding it hard. It's not straightforward. There's a lot of interconnected issues.
Yeah, but you're right. I mean, there's all these different systems which operate in any urban morphology, which relate to finance, relate to ecology, relate to society, and they all intersect and overlap. And you have self-reinforcing feedback loops, or negative, self-cancelling kind of loops. So the whole system is incredibly complicated, and when a planner goes in there and starts poking around, you can produce all kinds of unintended
consequences. One last question. If somebody like a mum and dad invest, I'm thinking people who are going to be soon to be first-time buyers, if they were to want to preserve backyard or nature, you know, for their own uses, what are the type of urban features that they should look for or avoid in finding their first block of land in a particular area?
In terms of finance, I wouldn't have too much faith in my advice, but I think, so yes, avoid the outer suburbs, avoid anything near water, like rivers and oceans. Sea level rise, you know, you might only get a few millimetres a year, but the erosion that goes with just a modest increase in sea level can extend 20, 30 metres inland.
Mm-hmm.
So I think giving the coast a mist would be probably a good idea.
Yep.
The middle ring suburbs look pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
I think the city centre, the enthusiasm for apartment living is right down now. Surveys we've done indicate that people are 25% less willing to live in an apartment since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic.
Right, yeah, absolutely.
So I think the middle ring suburbs look pretty good. And I also think regional areas, if they're not bushfire vulnerable,
mm-hmm.
And they have a measure of connectivity to the capital city, then I think that's probably not a bad thing to be looking at. Our surveys were showing that 40% of people were more inclined to live in the region since the pandemic, which mm-hmm. is a huge increase. People being drawn to areas which might be more self-sufficient, might have a stronger sense of community, might be more manageable centres. They're not global cities. They're cities you can conceptualise in your mind and where there's some kind of cohesion to the community. I think that's going to be increasingly valued.
Thank you, Julian. I appreciate your time this morning and all the work that you do at Audrec and as an academic and as a professional in urban design and landscape architecture. I wish you all the best.
Thank you, Katia. The interview was enjoyable.
Great.
And all the best to your podcast. Hope you
Thank
get lots
you.
Of listeners.